Part 15, Business as Usual. Kenneth Moore looks at the period when America was still technically at peace, while Britain was at war. He reminds us that American music became involved in a battle of its own. And in Britain, civilian life went on with whatever normality it could cling to. He recalls that not everybody went to war, but that often enough it came to them. And so did entertainment.
History was even more untidy than usual in bequeathing us not one, but two dates for the start of the Second World War. While the British enjoyed a phony war, and then endured a very real one, the Americans waged a phony peace for 2 years. And in 1939 and 40, and for all but the last few weeks of 1941, therefore, business in America could hardly be anything but usual. President Roosevelt's divisive Lend-Lease would begin to send us guns and other hardware by 1940, but we'd been getting perhaps 70% of our popular music from America for years before that, and we would continue to do so for a long time to come. So it's relevant to open this episode by hearing what was happening in peacetime America when we were already at war. To do that, it's absolutely essential to make use of the flashback and resurrect Glenn Miller, who in last week's part of our story had gone missing without trace. As our war broke out, Miller, in the commercial sense, was just arriving.
Around 1940 was the height of the big band era. All the big bands were playing, Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Tommy Dorsey, Jimmy Dorsey, Harry James, Les Brown, you name them. As a matter of fact, if you were in New York City at that time, you could go around to 20 different places of an evening and hear a big band and enjoy it, too. Either hear it in a ballroom or hear it in a hotel supper or dinner room, or else go to a theater or do any one of many, many places to hear, even amusement parks in the summertime. The big bands were just all over, and there were so many of them you could hear, and so many of them that were good.
The speaker is George Simon, author of two exhaustive books, one on Glenn Miller himself, another on the big bands in general. At the time, he was editor of the magazine Metronome, and the bands he mentioned were only a tiny fraction of those he heard and reviewed, so he knew who made up big bands' audiences.
Everybody. The kids would mostly go to the out-of-town places like the Glen Isle Casino and Frank Daly's Meadowbrook and the amusement parks. And, of course, they'd also go to the hotel rooms because the cover charge was very small and was 75 cents for a cover charge in those days, and drinks were not expensive. And kids could afford to go around and listen to the big bands and catch them in person, which is quite different, of course, what's happening today all over the world when these super rock groups rip off the kids for those fantastic prices for their services. And the older folks did also. They would go to some of the more expensive clubs where the bands might play. The kids, by the way, could also go and hear the bands in theaters. This was very big. You'd go into a theater in the morning and plunk down your 75 cents or whatever it was and stay all day if you wanted to. Nobody would kick you out. Of course, it meant you had to see the same feature picture three or four times. And sometimes it was funny. The kids, by the end of the day, would telegraph all the punchlines in the picture because they'd seen it several times before. But at least they saw their bands three or four, maybe even five times during the day. And they worship bands, you know, over here, just the way the sports fans over here worship baseball players and over in your country worship cricket players and soccer players. There's a tremendous hero worship among the kids and the performers in the big bands. Thank you.
Duke Ellington's orchestra with Take the A-Train. The big bands, when they weren't doing a resident engagement at some theatre, club or hotel, were of no fixed abode. They roosted in buses or trains and went through musicians the way children go through shoes. But as yet, the bands weren't feeling the draft, the American call-up. There were plenty of musicians, but in deference to an old American custom, some of the band leaders indulged in a certain amount of rustling. Cy Oliver, who himself had had an offer from Tommy Dorsey that he couldn't refuse, describes the process.
There was a great deal of that. In fact, I've known band leaders to pay much more than they can really afford to get a particular star, just to say that I had gotten him away from whoever he happened to be with. There was a great deal of that. In fact, after I began writing for Dorsey's band, I was approached by many of the major bands, and they offered ridiculous sums of money, but I knew what it was all about. I knew why they were doing it, and of course I wasn't interested. In those days, there was a great deal of what they call battles of music. One of the things that all the bands looked forward to was playing what they call a battle of music, which simply meant there were two bands engaged to play the same dance, you know. And, of course, the idea was to outdo the other band. It was just a matter of professional pride and excellence.
Dorsey's band, for the number not only arranged by Cy Oliver, but also composed by him and featuring him on vocal with a little help from Joe Stafford. The music you've heard so far today is the merest fraction of what was being produced in America as the 40s began. The Americans were still engaged in normal peacetime activities, and in their hundreds, the bands played on. The public called the tune, but on the whole, paid the pipers very well. The American jazz magazine Downbeat estimated that in 1940, Bob Crosby's band could expect to make about £60,000, of which £5,000 would go to Crosby, £3,400 to Ray Baduc, the drummer, and £3,000 to Bob Haggart, the bass player. Oh, by the way, Doris Day's share as the band's girl singer would be about £600. That £600 illustrates, as nothing else can, the humble status, well below the salt, that most band vocalists occupied in 1940. By the time their status had improved, something quietly revolutionary had also taken place on the Broadway musical stage. Pal Joey presented the musical theatre with its first real anti-hero, as well as one of its finest scores. Of course, for Joey Evans is a heel. He's the figure John O'Hara created in a series of short stories. But for every one person who knows the stories, there are 20 who know the tunes Richard Rodgers wrote for the stage adaptation's characters, and the words Lawrence Hart gave them to sing. Hart was possibly the most literate and lyrically daring of all the Broadway writers. He's certainly the most intriguing. Joshua Logan describes him.
Hart was a will-o'-the-wisp. He was very difficult. He was enchanting. He was cute. He was almost like a little gnome. He was terribly small. The cigars he smoked were bigger than his head, practically. And, you know, he was like Toulouse-Lautrec in a way. About the same look, same coloring. And I think maybe only a tiny bit taller. But, of course, he spoke English and not French. He was quite a lot older than Dick Rogers. But he had a theory of how music should be and how lyrics particularly should be, and started a kind of style that nobody had ever really accomplished before. Very few people realize what a vast number of lyrics Larry Hart wrote. You know, he's the most underrated man that ever lived, as far as I'm concerned, in our theater. I mean, everybody knows him and laughs at the jokes he pulled and the lyrics. I mean, there's never been a better lyric than couldn't sleep and wouldn't sleep until I could sleep where I shouldn't sleep. Now, that's a fantastic lyric line, so let's do it.
I'm wild again, beguiled again, a simpering, whimpering child again, bewitched. Until I could sleep where I shouldn't sleep, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. Lost my heart, but what of it? My mistake, I agree. He's a laugh, but I love it, because the laugh's on me. But still he is all mine, and I'll keep him until he is bewitched, bothered, and bewildered like me. Seen a lot, I mean a lot, but now I'm like sweet 17 a lot, bewitched. Spring to him and worship the trousers that cling to him, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. chest. Horizontally speaking, he's at his very best. Vexed again, perplexed again. Thank God I can be oversexed again. Bewitched, bothered and bewildered am I.
Bewitched, bothered, bewildered, and frequently bowdlerized. You would never have heard lines like "the trousers that cling to him," and "thank God I can be oversexed again" over the BBC in the early 1940s, since they were considered far too suggestive. At first, Pal Joey was something of an acquired taste. For those who did acquire it, it assumed great importance. Talking about it here are Betty Comden and Adolph Green, themselves lyric writers, librettists, and review artists.
Pal Joey was something we really looked up to as an ideal because it involved a certain Broadway gaiety and brilliance and music and lyrics that combined with a certain, we'd never seen before, a savagery and a look at the seamy side of life and a comment on false values and a certain kind of and maturity of characters. You know, it was a very honest, no punches pulled, unpleasant characterization. That was a sort of a thrilling example for us to look up to.
It sort of stuck out all by itself, because even for years after, there were shows that were not anything like it. It was just there in 1941 and maybe didn't have an immediate influence. It was certainly lambasted by the New York Times when it was revived. It was glowingly received.
Right, the same critic. Yes.
It did shock a lot of people and offended a lot of people, but it was a hit.
Betty Comden and Adolph Green on the delayed effect but great significance of Pal Joey. By 1943, Lawrence Hart, an erratic, alcoholic genius, was dead. So he never lived to see the show achieve classic status and never saw it made into a film. Had he bothered to notice it, however, even in 1940, the year of the original Pal Joey, the man who was to one day play the lead in the film was unwittingly starting another musical revolution himself. Working for Tommy Dorsey at the time was bandleader, arranger Paul Weston, and he recalls his first reaction to this newcomer.
Tommy told me, he said, "I'm getting this new singer from Harry James' band." And I said, "Well, what's his name?" And he said, "Well, it's Frank Sinatra." And I said, "Well, first thing we ought to do, Tom, is change his name, because," I said, "he'll never really mean much with that name like that."
Well, I don't know. Frank Sinatra doesn't sound too bad a name to me. Joe Stafford also has memories of Sinatra's arrival in the Dorsey band. She was already there as lead singer of the Pied Piper's vocal group.
We knew we were going to have a new boy singer, but we did not know who he was or anything about him. And we never saw Frank, as a matter of fact, until the first show. We were on stage, and Tommy announced, you know, they had a new boy singer, and out came this rather frail-looking young man with a whole bunch of hair. Not terribly impressive to look at, but sang about no more than 8 bars of Stardust, as I remember, and a great hush fell over the theater, and you knew you were hearing something completely new and completely unique and completely wonderful.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration. Stars were bright. You were in my nightingale told its fairy tale of paradise where roses grew. Though I dream in vain, in my heart it always will be. My stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain.
The immature but already distinctive voice of Frank Sinatra. At about the same period, 40 to 41, another singer was emerging, usually to be found just one leader behind Sinatra, Dick Hames. He was Frank's replacement in the Harry James Band, and for a few months he was with Tommy Dorsey after Sinatra had left for his solo career.
Well, Sinatra and I were always neck and neck. It happened at approximately the same time. It was happening to me with Harry, and it was at the same time happening to Frank with Tommy. And then we sort of outstripped the both of us. Frank and I outstripped the leaders. Frank became more important than Tommy, and I became more important than Harry. And Harry didn't particularly like it, obviously. But Tommy, being the showman that he was, I always have compared Tommy's philosophy to the philosophy of Jack Benny. You know, it's always been the Jack Benny show. Jack Benny's always been the star, but he's always surrounded himself with heavyweights. And he's let them do all the work, get all the laughs, and he's been the brunt of their jokes and so forth and so on. But he always emerges smelling like a rose, you know. And this is Tommy's philosophy. Tommy was a star maker. He, you know, consider the people he had in his band. He had Frank, he had myself, he had the Pied Pipers, he had Buddy Rich, he had Ziggy Ummen. He had Joe Bushkin on piano. Connie Haynes, Joe Stafford. The traveling arrangers with the band were Axel Stordahl, Cy Oliver, and Paul Weston were on the road with us, you know, and there was a showcase like you don't believe.
The events Dick Hames has just related didn't happen overnight. So here he is again describing how a singer could benefit from the showcase process.
He was one of the musicians until the public started to take notice. And one of the big step-ups for a vocalist was not to be forced to sit on the bandstand and snap your fingers whilst you weren't working. When one became big enough to demand that one needn't stay on the stand, then it was like a step up. It was a bit of prestige. You could sit at a table near the bandstand and so forth, and when you'd hear your intro music, you just sort of stroll up and do your number and so forth. Then you became sort of featured. In other words, you had to work your way up.
I'll get by as long as I. Maybe rain and darkness too. I won't complain. I'll see it through. Poverty may come to me. It's true. But what care I? I'll get by as long as I have you.
Well now, given a digestive tract made of asbestos, a distaste for sleeping, a fondness for living out of a suitcase, and the shrinking disposition of a politician or a prize fighter, life for the young American band leader, band musician or singer was full of promise around 1940. Talent was an advantage too, but you also needed exposure. It came at that time through live radio as well as records. In fact, the two were linked. Dick Hames explains how it worked if, for instance, a band did a short season at somewhere like the Blue Room of the Lincoln Hotel in New York.
Well, from there, one would get what used to be called remotes. Early in the evening, one network would come in, and we'd be on the air for half an hour. And then towards the end of an evening, another network would come in, and we'd be on the air for half an hour. Now, what you did with the remotes is you plugged the hell out of your records, and you did them over and over and over again, which sparked the sales of the records as well. So this is the way you got coverage.
Poverty may come to me, it's true.
what care I, say I'll get by, as long as I have you.
Dick Hames and the Harry James Band. And if you were the writer of that song, you did a good deal better than simply get by. As long as you were a member of ASCAP, the American Society of Authors, Composers, and Publishers, which collected money on your behalf from anyone who used your music in public for profit. If you didn't belong to ASCAP, which at the time was a very exclusive club, admitting only those it considered good enough, you got nothing. America's few large radio networks and its myriads of smaller stations operated for profit, and were very heavy users of music, nearly all of it composed and published by ASCAP members. As 1940 and an existing agreement came to an end, ASCAP announced the sharply increased rates it proposed to charge in future. The broadcasters rebelled, and from January the 1st, 1941, refused to play any ASCAP music over the air. Indeed, once they decided not to pay, they had no choice anyway. This left them little but traditional airs, some hillbilly songs, the odd blues, and Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair. It meant that bands and singers were faced with the prospect of going off the air, for almost everything they did was ASCAP stuff. They couldn't promote their new records, and authors and composers couldn't promote their new songs. You can imagine the effect on band leaders, Les Brown for one.
Yes, we played Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair every show during the ban. We were only allowed to do non-ASCAP tunes at the time. And we had to get a new book overnight if we wanted to play on the air. So we did, because we wanted the exposure.
Les Brown's band getting along with non-ASCAP music. Between January and October 1941, it was ASCAP versus the broadcasters, and virtually no ASCAP music was heard on the air. In anticipation of this almost Gilbertian situation, though Gilbert and Sullivan were still safely within copyright, the broadcasters had set up their own licensing and collection agency, Broadcast Music Incorporated.
Well, the plan was simply this, that there was a good deal of music that was not being paid for. There were a great many musicians in addition to the thousand who belonged to ASCAP. And the theory was that we could get those musicians to create a repertory which would be truly competitive with the ASCAP repertory.
But BMI started on a campaign to knock off ASCAP. And what they did was to sign anybody who could write a song. It made no difference, good, bad, or indifferent. They just signed everybody. And guaranteed these writers a certain number of performances per song and a certain amount of royalties, whether the songs earned it or not. And I remember seeing literature which went around to all their various studios. One in particular said, people will never miss what they don't hear. But I think the quality of what we were given was way below what the people should have had.
Now, it so happened that BMI turned out to be the best possible thing for the American music business and also for ASCAP. The new ethnic writer, for instance, let us say, the hillbilly writer from Tennessee, the black blues writer from Arkansas or Texas or Alabama or Mississippi, could hardly get into ASCAP at all. They weren't interested. They were interested in the people who wrote Broadway shows and movie scores. And that was about it. BMI welcomed all the new unheard-of writers. So when the ASCAP strike started, we found ourselves using a whole lot of old standard material whose copyrights had lapsed. And we existed on revivals of old Black Joe and My Old Kentucky Home and things like that.
ASCAP made the false assumption the public would complain. Nobody complained. Nobody. They didn't mind it. They didn't miss all the damn songs that they'd heard all those years. And ASCAP made a dreadful error in forcing the broadcasters into the performing rights business.
Now, I tell you, I used to look at the top 30 songs in the 1940s, and the top 30 songs were all ASCAP. All by the pop standards writers. Now and again a song from another field, but mainly they were the top 30 were by the pop standards writers. Then, with the formation of BMI, it became 28-2 BMI, 25-5 BMI, 2010, 15-15, and I thought this was all fair. But when it became 10-20 BMI, 525 BMI and 1 week 30 BMI songs. Well, I don't have to be any kind of legalistic mind to know that something is amiss here. Suddenly, not one pop standard writer can get on the list of popular songs. And what they have done, I think, is a great, great disservice to the art of music as I know it.
Well, there should never have been a BMI, because if it hadn't been for the arrogance of the people who were running ASCAP, the broadcasters would never have gone to the trouble to make BMI. As a matter of fact, the last offer that ASCAP turned down, if they had accepted it, today they would be something like $400 million richer.
So, fundamentally, it was about money. And how you viewed it depended, of course, on what it did to your wallet. But its effect on music was enormous. For it hurried into the open the influences which would eventually create rock and roll. In other words, it actually shortened our story. Meanwhile, of course, the British had been fighting a real battle.
Here
a big department store, there's a girl whose heart sings a song. She's had word to say he's on his way, and now it won't be long. a boy coming home on leave. There's a girl wants him home on leave. She'll meet him right at the station, and she will tell all the nation. There's a boy coming home on leave, and his heart won't be on his sleeve. They'll have a grand celebration when he comes home on leave. And as they meet, he'll tell her how he's missed her. That's after he's kissed her. And then they'll talk about that wedding morning. They'll plan a honeymoon. The army can't wait till June. There's a boy coming home on leave. He'll enjoy coming home on leave. They'll make it 10 days of heaven when he comes home on leave.
For civilians, wartime Britain was an eerie mixture of nightmare, abnormality, and a determination as far as possible to conduct business as usual. When September and October 1939 came and went, and there was still no sign of Goering and his demolition experts, relief at not finding themselves beneath a layer of rubble led the British, or some of them, to the inevitable reaction. By November, the West End, that starch-collared Xanadu, ruled over by the society band leaders, was back in almost full production. 50 bands were working every night in London, patriotically playing such things as Berlin or Bust, the Army, the Navy and the Air Force, Crash Bang, I Want to Go Home, which was not a premonition of the Blitz, but a song about the blackout, and They Can't Black Out the Moon. As 1940 opened, the start of the BBC Forces programmes and the beginning of rationing happened on successive days. The war may have been phony at that moment, but the shortages were becoming real enough, and in any case, the war wasn't to remain phony much longer.
Summer, you old Indian summer, you're the tear that comes after Juneside's laughter. You see so many dreams that don't come true. Dreams we fashioned when summer time was new. You are here to watch over some heart that is broken by a word that somebody left unspoken. You're the ghost of a romance in June, going astray, fading too soon. That's why I say farewell to you, Indian summer.
With a kind of prophetic irony, that song, 1939 words added to a 1919 Victor Herbert tune, reached the height of its popularity just as the Indian summer of the so-called phony war was drawing to a close. There's another irony in the fact that when, after the fall of France and the Battle of Britain, the war really came to the British civilian, the theatres did the reverse of what they'd done in 1939 and defiantly stayed open. The routine horror of the Blitz was somehow accommodated in the pattern of people's lives, even when they went to the theatre. Here's how things were managed at the London Palladium, as Florence Desmond remembers them.
Well, it was a curious thing, really. We got used to it. The show didn't stop. If there was an air raid, there used to be a red light flashed in front of the footlights, saying an alert has been sounded. And then very often you'd hear the bombs falling and the guns going, but the show still went on. And then when the all clear came, a green light flashed. But I don't remember ever seeing the audience get up and leave the theatre. It was the most amazing thing, that. I think they must have looked at us up on the stage and thought, well, if they can go through it, we can.
I'll never forget the people I met braving those angry skies. I remember well as the shadows fell, the life of hope in their eyes. And though I'm far away, I still can hear them say, thumbs up. For when the dawn comes up, there'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover. Tomorrow, just you wait and see. There'll be love and laughter and peace ever after. Tomorrow, when the world is free, the shepherd will tend his sheep. The valley will bloom again, and Jimmy will go to sleep in his own little room again. There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover. Tomorrow, just you wait and see.
Vera Lynn, promoted by the war from a mere singer to being a symbol for forces and civilians alike. One of the things that helped to establish her was the long run of Apple Sauce at the London Palladium, in which she starred with Florence Desmond. The Palladium later on presented the show, which was symbolic from start to finish.
Army, Mr. Jones. No private rooms or telephones. You had your breakfast in bed before, but you won't have it there anymore.
Brought over intact from America, This Is the Army was devised and written by Irving Berlin, who, as you just heard, took it upon himself to appear in it also. Here he recalls that patriotic all-soldier review.
I would say that was the highest spot, emotional spot in my so-called career. I don't think I've had anything that meant as much to me as This Is the Army. I spent about 3.5 years with it. We played in America for over a year. Then we went to Hollywood and made a picture of it. And then came overseas and opened at the Palladium here. And we played partly for your British service charities. And I think the figure we got for that was about $350,000. Part of the audience paid, but two-thirds were the armed forces who got in free. And incidentally, I wrote a song for that opening, which earned some money. I think it got about $20,000 for the fund. And it may sound corny now, but it was very timely at that time. It's called My British Buddy. I don't know whether you remember it. My British Buddy, we're as different as can be. He thinks he's winning the war, and I think it's me, but we're in there pitching, and on one thing we agree, when the war is won, the job is done, we'll be clasping hands across the sea. It was very exciting at that time.
I arrived in London just the other day, speaking to a soldier from the USA. He told me of the army life he led. And speaking of the British boys, he said, my British buddy, we're as different as can be. He thinks he's winning the war, and I think it's me, but we're in there pitching, and on one thing we agree, when the job is done and the war this one, we'll be clasping hands across the sea.
My brilliant body, we're different than can be.
I like my coffee at Rome, and he likes his tea, but we're in bed. Can we get to Germany?
When the talk is done and the war is won, we'll be planting hands across the sea.
But only a tiny proportion of the British civilian public ever got in to see Irving Berlin's This Is the Army. In fact, only a minority could get to a theatre to see anything live. By far the biggest audience was sitting at home, or in shelters, or on fire-watching duty, or working in factories, or at sea, or wherever people could listen to those cumbersome radio sets of the 40s.
To start broadcasting, and then the warning would go, the air raid warning, and then we'd go on to shortwave and still continue broadcasting, and then we couldn't come out because there was an air raid going on outside. So we used to have mattresses on the floor in the bottom of the Paris cinema and try and sleep down there, and then when the all clear went in the morning, we'd get up, go back to our respective homes, have a shave and a bath, and come and start broadcasting again. There's one interesting anecdote about this. You remember this character that they had broadcasting from Germany, Haw Haw? He came on the radio one evening just after an air raid warning had gone, and this is what he said, as far as I can remember. He says, you know, the air raid warning has just gone off in London, and German aeroplanes are flying over, dropping their firebombs, and London is alight, and through all this, Geraldo and his orchestra go on broadcasting. So that's something that we will always remember.
Broadcasting, of course, could reach nearly everybody. But there was a real need for live entertainment, too, not only among troops, but among munition and other wartime factory workers. If they couldn't get to the theatre or dance halls, then the entertainers went to them.
We went by train and we went by coach, you see. No, it wasn't bad. One was so enthused about what you were doing, you felt you were doing a great job of work, but you forgot about any inconveniences at all. And there weren't many. Everyone fated us like mad when we got to the different factories. And if we had been slightly inconvenienced in any shape or form, and I don't think we were, it all made up for it when we got there. And the reception that we used to get from the workers was second to none, the same as it would be if we went into the theatre of war with the troops. They absolutely ravished in it.
And you didn't have to be grown up to be a valuable and useful entertainer. If Vera Lynn was the force's sweetheart, Petula Clark, at the age of 12, or about 12, was everybody's daughter.
I used to travel in troop trains. And, of course, there were no lights. It was kind of strange. And I used to sleep in the luggage rack, because that was the most comfortable place for me.
Nothing I do
to make me forget that I still love you, kiss you. In my dreams I kiss you. Whispering.
Though I dream in vain.
Tell me, do you ever miss me as I miss
you? Now there's an appropriate song to be hearing in the summer of 1942. But after the end of July that year, he wouldn't have heard it, not on the BBC anyway. For there then broke out one of two wars within the war. In fact, it seems to have been a war within the BBC itself, where a faction had grown up which believed that what was needed over the air were robust, manly, stirring songs. In opposition were those who felt that the sentimental material did no harm. The cold bath faction appears to have gained the upper hand, and the BBC began to give us what it thought was good for us. As Cecil Madden, who was then a BBC program executive, explains, the corporation's method was exactly what you'd expect.
The BBC set up a committee, which got nicknamed the Slush Committee, and we had every week to go through mountains of songs, records, and everything else, and we most unfortunately had to ban songs, and this caused frightful rows with the publishers, and we existed to ban things, which was very unfortunate. Because one likes to be creative.
What the BBC wanted to ban fell into four categories. Numbers which are slushy in sentiment, anemic or debilitated vocal performances by male singers, insincere or over-sentimental style of performances by a woman singer, and numbers based on tunes borrowed from the classics. Well, I suppose the BBC had all our best interests at heart, but somehow I don't think this would really have damaged our moral fibre.
You're alone and you're miles away from home. Remember, somewhere somebody cares about you. Things may go wrong, but they can't go wrong for long. Remember, somewhere cares about you.
We can only suppose that that one was banned as an insincere or over-sentimental style of performance by a woman singer. Then there were those anemic or debilitated vocal performances by male singers.
Couple of jiggers of moonlight and a star, or in the blue of a June night and one guitar. Mix in a couple of dreamers and there you are. Lovers hail the moonlight cocktail. Now add a couple of flowers, a drop of dew. Stir for a couple of hours till dreams come true. As to the number of kisses, it's up to you. Moonlight cocktails need a few.
And those naughty borrowed classics.
Thank you.
appropriated classics were to remain banned for a long time to come. In fact, until the borrowed-borrowed-in of the successful Kismet made the whole situation ridiculous. But sentiment will out, and as far as that part of the scheme was concerned, the control was ineffective and short-lived. While the BBC was rather ill-advisedly trying to ban slush on this side of the Atlantic, the American Federation of Musicians, over on the other, had set itself the enormous task of trying to ban records. Their case was that the gramophone record, in its original role of a device for home entertainment, was fine, but over the years it had become the basic raw material of radio broadcasting and, through the jukebox, of public entertainment, and was therefore doing musicians out of their job. The union didn't actually specify what should be done about it, but until something was done, the musicians would simply make no more records. And they didn't, for over 2 years. In view of that, there's only one way to end this episode. In total silence.
Ragtime to Rock and Roll was narrated by Kenneth Moore and written by Peter Clayton. The research was by Bill Sullivan, and the producer was John Billingham. Next week, over there, America continues to be the fountainhead of popular music, in spite of a strike by musicians, with a new musical partnership producing a new kind of musical, and Hollywood in full production.